history podcast dedicated to connecting the past to the present and correcting historical and political illiteracy. I'm Colin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jay. And today we've got a great episode, series of episodes, I should say, on the fall of the antebellum South. Jay's going to take us through the Old South, all the way to Sherman's March to the Sea and Reconstruction. So it's going to be an exciting mini-series, and I think I'm looking forward to it as well. Before we dive in, Jay, I do want to give a couple shout-outs.
As we've mentioned,
if you give us a 5-star and a review and a comment so we can see your name, we'll give you a shout-out. We got a couple of them. So Blaine O'Shaughnessy, 685, I appreciate that you are not bots. Great discussion. Thank you. We are definitely not bots.
Tyler Thanks, Schoen, O'Shea Hennessy.
5640. Yeah, O'Shea Hennessy. 5643. Fellas, this is amazing. I listened to thousands of hours of podcasts, audiobooks, YouTube videos, etc. This is very relatable and easy for an easy listen for an hour. Just keep putting this level into it and you'll boom. We're hoping so, Tyler.
Thanks,
Nick
Tyler.
Nick Daughter, 1792. Hell yeah, dude.
Yeah.
Hell yeah to you, Nick. Vasio 9752. Great episode. I've been playing Medieval Total War, and this helps put things into perspective.
Nice.
First off, that is a fantastic game. Total War 2 like came out in like 2006. Classic.
Yes.
Still, if I had more time, I'd play it.
Yeah. Spent a lot of time playing Medieval Total War back in the day.
And then Tumia 1, comment for the algo. Appreciate that people are making podcasts about history. Well, I appreciate that. We've been wanting that.
We appreciate you, man.
Yeah, so there's for the shout outs. Jay, can you get us started?
Yeah, no, for sure. Thank you, Colin, and thank you to our listeners out there. We definitely enjoy connecting with y'all. It makes this a little bit more personal as opposed to just, y'all listening to two random dudes on a podcast. So appreciate the love and the support. Okay. You know, hard shift from a happy tone to something that is going to be deeply personal to a lot of us here. And that is the fall of the antebellum South. As we've been walking the dog through, the fall of the Roman Empire, the fall of the Han Dynasty, we just finished our series on the fall of the Byzantine Empire. We now shift to something more modern, something closer to home here in the States, and something much more personal. So I wanted to start off this episode with a quote from what is arguably the greatest American novel ever written. In terms of sales, it is the highest grossing American novel, and that is Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell. I wanted to start with a quote. We're here at the end, basically the end of the story, or towards the end. The Civil War is over. We have two characters, Scarlett O'Hara and a guy named Ashley Wilkes. Just for context, probably the most famous quote out of the movie is, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn." That was by a character named Rhett Butler, not Ashley Wilkes. So this isn't that guy. This is a different guy. And Ashley Wilkes he's actually plowing his own field, which is important, because Ashley Wilkes grew up in this Georgian aristocracy, and it's after the Civil War. It's literally the first time he's ever had to work with his own hands. He's plowing his own field, and Scarlett O'Hara is kind of in a frenzy, as she often is in this story. And she comes up to him, and she's kind of in panic. They don't have their slaves. They've lost the war. The Old South is gone. And she walks up on Ashley plowing his own field. Mitchell writes, "Ashley put down the axe and looked away, and his eyes seemed to be journeying off to some far off country where she could not follow. I wonder," he said, "I wonder not only what will become of us at Terra, but what will become of everybody in the South." She felt like snapping out abruptly, "To hell with everybody in the South. What about us?" But she remained silent because the tired feeling was back on her more strongly than ever. Ashley wasn't being any help at all. This is Ashley talking. In the end, what will happen will be what has happened whenever a civilization breaks up. The people who have brains and courage come through, and the ones who haven't are winnowed out. At least it has been interesting, if not comfortable, to witness a Götterdämmerung. A what? Scarlett asks. A dusk of the gods. Unfortunately, we Southerners did think we were gods. And I feel like that little scene captures the feeling, the mood that I want us to be in for this podcast episode. You know, the title of the book, Gone with the Wind, is referring to what Mitchell calls the Old South, what's more probably more popularly known as the Antebellum South. And that is that civilization, as Ashley speaks of, is gone, and it no longer exists. That unique culture, that unique civilization, it ceased to exist. And that's what we're going to talk about here in this episode. And we're going to talk about why that happened. We're going to talk about how it happened. We're going to talk about its implications and its effects for today. And I'm pretty excited to talk about it. Been waiting for this for a few weeks now. So
I think it's also important to note that this is like we mentioned in the intro, connecting the past to the present. Like right now this is very important for today, because if you've been following the news in the Arlington Cemetery, they're actually taking down the Confederate Memorial. And it was kind of like it was built about 100 years ago as like a reconciliation memorial between the North and the South to try and kind of patch things over, because about 100 years ago, there still would have been quite a few Civil War veterans alive. And it wouldn't have been some distant event that occurred. It would have been something that was fresh in the minds, but still very much a sore and open wound for a lot of people. And that's being torn down, or I don't know if they've actually started tearing it down or what, but that was the plan to tear that down. And there's all the memorials being moved or taken down as well. So it is something that you can look in the news and now get an understanding for what was going on during the Civil War and before then.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a perfect segue into the one disclaimer that I wanted to talk about before we, you know, really get through an overview of what this episode's going to be about. I think, and just so that it's said, my personal opinion is that removing Confederate monuments is the wrong call. I think it's a bad decision, and it does more harm than good. But in order to make that statement, I think we have to understand both sides. And that's kind of my disclaimer, is this series, this three episode series, this episode in particular, is going to seek to do two things. And that is, first, it's going to present a sympathetic view of the antebellum South. And what I mean by sympathetic is not a uncritical and not a, hey, everything, the South should have won. That's not what you're going to hear from me. But it is going to seek to understand the South. And I think we have to do that when we understand, when we ask the question, why did the South fall? And and I'm specifically asking that question as opposed to why did the South lose the Civil War? Because that question gets, asked frequently, but it doesn't encompass really what I want to capture. And that is like the cultural and the socioeconomic aspects of what the South was. So in order to understand why that civilization ceased to exist, we have to understand it comprehensively. However, and this is the second thing that this series is going to seek to do, and that is acknowledge sins. And I'm specifically saying the word sins because, you know, in the modern day, maybe a little bit more 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, the South was referred to as the Bible Belt. And I'm specifically speaking to those of us that are sympathetic with the South. And that is like the whole reason why monuments get removed is because there tends to be this like defensive, just, you know, self-justification that occurs when you know, addressing the sins of the South. And there were many. And I think we have to recognize that and acknowledge that when we talk about why the civilization fell. You know, a key theme of our series here, you know, when we talk about Rome, when we talk about the Han, when we talked about the Byzantines, is like they made mistakes. They made errors. They flat out did things that were harmful to their own civilization and to others. And when you do those kinds of things, you are putting your own society at risk. And I think the South has to wake up, you know, and I'm speaking to Southern conservatives in particular. We have to recognize that, yes, while there were many redeeming qualities, while there were many good things about the South, there were also a lot of bad things, and we have to do both. So to kind of summarize my disclaimer here is we're doing both here. We're being sympathetic to the South. I feel comfortable saying that Colin and I are, I think I've referenced this before, we're both from the South. We were born and raised in the South. And we're going to present a sympathetic view, but at the same time, we're going to call a spade, and we're going to, you know, acknowledge sins where they are.
I think to summarize your summary, it's neither a liberal or conservative slant. It's not a right or left slant. We don't want a lot of people reading it and being like, oh, they're a bunch of crazy liberals or crazy Republicans coming in here. It's not. It's just, yeah, this is both sides of the history. I think a controversial historical figure, Howard Zinn, wrote a book like The People's History of America. And his whole preface of it was like, hey, I'm just kind of telling the other side of history. Now, whatever your thoughts on Howard Zinn are as a historian, but that's kind of the preface he makes when he tells the people's history of the United States. And that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah. I think there's a lot more to say there, but for the sake of time, because we have a lot of ground to cover here. We're going to go ahead and press. And I did want to say, if you stay with us to the very end, I'm going to give a book recommendation that I can almost guarantee you, you've probably never heard of this book, and it has been extremely helpful in prep for this episode. So hang out with us until the very end, and I'll give y'all a book recommendation that I very much suggest that y'all read. Okay, moving on. This series is going to just going to be, we've planned three episodes. We'll see how far we get. It might go longer. It's definitely not going to go shorter. Three episodes. This first episode and today we're going to talk about what was the antebellum South. Really want to define, like, okay, we're talking about this culture that fell, the society that fell. What was it? What made it unique? What made it distinct? What were the key aspects of that culture? The second episode is going to focus on, next week's episode is going to focus on how the South fell. So we're going to talk Civil War next week, but we're going to focus on Sherman's March to the Sea. And the reason we're going to focus on Sherman's March to the Sea is not so much because, you know, of like tactical military considerations as much as it is when, in many places in the South, when looking back on the Civil War, Sherman's March to the Sea is seen as the most destructive and damaging event of the Civil War because it was viewed as like Sherman was intentionally trying to break the will of the Southern people. He wasn't necessarily trying to win a tactical military victory. Rather, Sherman was trying – he was attacking – the civilization. He wasn't attacking, you know, the Army of Northern Virginia or, you know, a cavalry unit in Tennessee like he did at Shiloh. He was trying to break the back of the South. So that's why we're going to focus on Sherman's March to the Sea. And then our third episode, we're going to focus on Reconstruction. You know, it was a battle between radical Reconstruction, radical Republicans who were literally trying to purge the Southern states of this culture, And more moderates who favored reconciliation, like, hey, let's move forward, let's forgive and forget, etc. And this, I mean, we talked about removing the Confederate statue in Arlington Cemetery at the beginning of this episode, but like those two views in Reconstruction are very much still prevalent today, and they have adapted themselves to our present circumstances. So it's worth talking about. Okay, next topic here. Why view the South as a fallen civilization? And in this episode, I'm going to make the argument that the antebellum South was a distinct civilization with a distinct culture, a distinct value system, and in 1860, it became a distinct government. That civilization ceased to exist, you know, from 1865, in the immediate aftermath, it was put away, and a lot of these things. The key takeaways that I think we're going to get into over the next three episodes, so this isn't just for this episode, but really the whole series, is the three main reasons why the South fell. Pride, racism and white supremacy, and a lack of modernization. Pride, as you know, kind of referenced in the Gone with the Wind quote there at the beginning, like, unfortunately, we Southerners did think we were gods. Like, there was, the South thought they were, you know, better than they actually were, and they held themselves over and above probably what they should have. Secondly, racism and white supremacy, like, you know, acknowledging sins where we see them. I personally, like, cringe at the majority of conversation nowadays surrounding racism and white supremacy. But the simple fact of the matter is that, you know, white supremacy was alive and well in the antebellum South, and they really did look down on Black people as the inferior race, and that led to its downfall. You know, specifically, you know, tying this to, like, answering the question, why did the South fall? Racism and white supremacy absolutely played a role, and we'll discuss how it played a role in its downfall over these three episodes. And then lastly, a lack of modernization. And I say that because commonly in, like, you know, answering the question, why did the South lose the Civil War? It's like a lack of industrialization is common, as a common answer. And that is very true. But I even want to take it one step further, specifically focusing on the culture, and say, you know, a theme that our listeners, if you've stayed with us for over 50 plus episodes since the beginning, is that a thing that I've referenced a few times now is conservatism, when it's only just trying to defend the past, it loses. When conservatism doesn't progress, like when conservatism doesn't adapt itself to the future, when it doesn't provide a positive vision, it only seeks to retain, hey, don't do this, don't do that, don't take away, you know, this, that, and the other, a primarily negative vision. When conservatism only has a negative vision, and what we saw in the South, in that it's a lack of modernization, you know, this idea that cotton is king, and that our role in this capitalistic economy, our role in the American culture, is we're going to kind of just stay the way that we are, and we're going to seek to defend the status quo, that actually leads to a downfall. And I think that lesson can be applied to, you know, really everybody, but the West writ large that we talked about in previous episodes. And that is, like, okay, there is a place for defending the status quo, but I believe the best way to defend the status quo is to actually present a positive vision for what it looks like for the good things about the status quo to move forward. So those are the key takeaways on why I believe the antebellum South fell. So next topic, We're going to ask the question, what was the antebellum South? Like, what are some facts about the antebellum South to kind of help us understand this distinct civilization, this distinct culture? We're going to talk about the ethnic background of white people, the ruling elite. We're going to discuss the ratio, just sheer numbers of slaves to free, to black people, to white people. We're going to talk about the aristocratic landed culture that dominated the South. And then we're going to talk about politics and religious views that kind of like, how did the South think? What were common arguments? How did it justify slavery? Like, how did it see its place in the world? So that's what we're going to talk about. All right. First, the ethnic background. And so in the antebellum South, the vast majority of people were white people from the British Isles. And this is important because, you know, if you think in the 1860s, we are not even a century. The country is not even 100 years old, meaning that we're really only talking about two or three generations removed from people who lived in the British Isles. And it's important to keep that fact in mind, because a lot of the cultural value system of these people, they brought with them from the British Isles. So the main three are obviously English, but then we're going to talk about Scottish / Scots-Irish, and we're going to talk about the Irish. So this is going to come up later, and I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but like, so you had English that settled primarily in like the Virginia, Eastern North Carolina, Low Country, South Carolina, like coastal plain tidewater areas. Like, they were the easiest places to get to. They were the big cities on the coast. And you know, Richmond, Virginia was a big place. Charleston, South Carolina was a big place. New Bern, North Carolina, for those of y'all that are familiar with that small town. This is completely random. Obviously, I think a lot of people know that North and South Carolina in the colonial times was actually the same. It was one colony. It was the Carolina colony was formed by the nine lords proprietor, and its capital was in Charleston. And it was dominated by a river network. A lot of the rivers in both North and South Carolina flow from northwest to southeast. So with a capital in Charleston, South Carolina, it allowed easy access to go upriver. And that's kind of how the migration flow in both North and South Carolina. But very quickly, they realized with a capital in South Carolina, like, you know, what is now known as North Carolina is a long ways away, and the rivers don't exactly go perfectly up into North Carolina. So the first capital of North Carolina was a place called New Bern, and it is a tiny little town today, but the governor headquarters is a building you can still go visit. And I highly recommend, fun fact about New Bern, it's also the place where Pepsi was invented. So go figure. Full of all kinds of random facts here.
You're blowing my mind. Blowing
some history. Yeah. So anyway, and I've obviously been to New Bern. It is a great place to go visit. Shout out to New Bern, North Carolina. Okay. You know, that's where the English settled. Beyond that was when you started getting a lot of Scottish, Scots-Irish, and Irish. And within British Isles culture, they were considered minority. That's why they had to push further inland. So a lot of the more rural, so in the Appalachian Mountains, in the Cumberland Plateau, in the mountains of North Georgia, on in into the deep South, like the mountains of Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, etc. That's where you started getting a lot of Irish, Scottish, and Scots-Irish. And just for the record, the Scots-Irish are people who were ethnic Scots who through English incentivization moved to Ireland as a part of the Protestant colonization of Catholic Ireland. Whew, go figure, all kinds of fun facts here. Primarily only moved to Ulster County, which is the northern county in Ireland. That's why North Ireland with Belfast has a lot of conflict because of the Protestants, Catholics. It's because the English incentivized Scottish to immigrate into Ireland. They, you know, intermarried, mixed in, and created a noteworthy subculture named Scots Irish. A lot of those people do the violence, there's famine, etc. They immigrated to the United States after that. And then, of course, just pure-blooded Irish also immigrated.
Going a little further back, the name Scotland comes from the Scotty tribe, which was actually a tribe of barbarians from Ireland. So the this Irish group called the Scotty invaded what is now Scotland or Pictland at the time, or Caledonia by the Romans. Mm. So extreme amounts of intergroup relations between the Scotch Irish. They're basically one people, more or less.
Yeah. Gaelic.
They will obviously, they would be enraged to hear that, but I mean, they go back historically that yes. they are very similar.
Yes. So that's kind of the ethnic makeup of white people in the South. There were, there's obviously other folks. There was a large German speaking population in Texas. Specifically focusing on the South here. There's obviously German populations elsewhere, but in the South, it was in Texas. There were French in Louisiana. There were other cultures, but predominantly English, Scottish, Irish, Scots-Irish, all over the South. This created an honor culture. And Malcolm Gladwell, in his book Outliers, has a really good explanation on Scots-Irish and honor culture and getting pissed off when someone offends your honor. Won't go into detail here because that's too far of a rabbit trail, but recommend checking that out. He quotes a fascinating University of Michigan study that basically talks about Scots-Irish people get pissed off more frequently than non-Scots-Irish. Anyway, that's kind of why it's worth mentioning. He also talks about the Hatfields and McCoys and there being more family feuds in the Cumberland Plateau than anywhere else in the country. And it's primarily because they were all Scots-Irish and had this honor culture. This reality is very pertinent to kind of understanding the South and kind of understanding, and we'll go more into honor culture here in a little bit. But before we do that, I also want to talk about the ethnic background in terms of whites versus blacks. In the 1860 census, there were roughly 12 million people in the South. Of those 12 million people, roughly 8 million were white, 4 million were black. And of those 4 million, 3.9 million of them were slave. There were only 261,000 free blacks in the South as of 1860. The decades, especially the 20 years leading up to that point, there was quite a bit of, migration, both voluntary and involuntary. There was the Underground Railroad. There was a lot of movement, but just in 1860, only 261 of those were free blacks. So that's roughly a 2-to-1 ratio, 2 white people for every 1 black person. However, that's encompasses the entire South. There were 2 states in particular that over 50% of the population was black, and that is in Mississippi and South Carolina, which is helpful to understand because these states were vehemently pro-slavery and violently defended the institution of slavery. And it's helpful to understand, they were majority slaves. They had more slaves than any other 2 states in the South. And it's you're economically incentivized, you're culturally incentivized. Slavery is just part of your way of life there. You're more reliant upon the institution, etc. Okay. Let's move on now to talk about the aristocratic culture within the South. And for those of y'all, you know, I've kind of already referenced Gone with the Wind, but even the movie is fantastic. Sorry, go ahead, Colin.
Jay, I was going to say, so you went through kind of the demographics of it. Do we know how many of like the Southerners, the white Southerners that actually owned slaves or?
Yes.
And how, and what that breakdown was, because obviously there's plantations like Boone Hall that are massive and probably had like, it was like 100 to 1. And then there's other maybe lesser aristocrats or wealthy people that may have had 1 or 2 slaves. Is there, did that, how granular did they get that breakdown?
Yes. So the only stat that I have there is approximately 25 to 30% of white people in the South own slaves. It's also kind of different because a patriarchal culture was, you know, nearly universal within the South. So when we say that 25 to 30% of people own slaves, I honestly don't know if that number is including the women. It could be possible. I honestly don't know if that number includes men and women who own slaves or if it's only including the men who own slaves. Nevertheless, the one stat that I have is that roughly 25 to 30% of the people own slaves. Now, someone might say, two-thirds of the South didn't even own slaves. Like, okay, that is true, but nearly 100%, you know, and this is Jay, you know, shooting from the hip, but it's like 100% of white people were dependent economically at a minimum on the institution of slavery. Like it just played a role in everyone's life, even if you didn't own a slave yourself.
That's a huge point. And you'll probably get into it later, but as we were talking about this, getting ready for the episode, I had that exact thought, like, even if everyone in the South was suddenly without a war starting, like, hey, slavery is bad, we don't want to do this anymore, and like poof, overnight, slavery ended, what would the economy do? So there had to be that element of in the non-slave owning whites, it's like, well, hey, my whole job depends on being able to get cheap cotton or cheap rice or something like that. So, and maybe it's a third or fourth level effect where they're down the line, but yes, like they couldn't just say, yeah, no, I don't directly partake in it, but I indirectly receive some type of benefit. So yes, they were incentivized to maintain that practice.
Yes. And we'll get into this in our third episode on Reconstruction, but a lot of the things that Southerners were predicting, economically speaking, if, you know, they freed the slaves, absolutely became true. You know, just one, probably not the most significant, but the one that comes to mind now is just the reality of when you increase the labor market by one third, and all of a sudden those slaves that you didn't have to pay money for their labor, you have paid it, you have paid an upfront cost, but if you were good and you had generational slavery and, you know, they're having kids and that kind of thing, your wage for that labor becomes zero. Well, when you introduce all of a sudden now these people are part of the competitive labor market, what does that do? When you increase supply, the price goes way down, i.e. wages goes way the freak down. And essentially what you had during Reconstruction, due to just pure economic factors alone, the labor cost hit rock bottom. And what that does is like, okay, you're not making a wage that you can actually live off of. And, you know, there was a common thing that before the Civil War, it's like, we're going to have to compete against black people for wages. And now we look at it and go like, yeah, get over it. Like they deserve a wage too. But the reality is like, you know, this guy's like, how am I going to buy food? Like, how am I going to, you know, buy seed to farm my field when my wages are no longer sufficient for me to maintain, you know, the standard of living? That was a legitimate concern, and it absolutely came true. Again, not trying to say that justifies the institution of slavery, just trying to say that, you know, there were negative consequences in that regard.
I think that falls more on the plan to rebuild afterward. And do we even really have one? How do we address this issue 5 years in advance so we kind of know what's coming rather than, whoops, we're here.
Yeah. Okay. Moving into the aristocratic culture. And this that's actually a good segue into kind of understanding like, okay, who are the main decision makers in the South? Who, like culturally speaking, who were the cultural elite? You know, today we might say that the cultural elite are like wealthy C-suite executives, a part of the IT and healthcare sector. You know, the people with the billionaires that get to, you know, the George Soros's of the world, they're the people that have a significantly outsized influence on politics, economic decisions, et cetera. In the antebellum South, it was by far plantation owners. And these plantation owners, you know, the cash crop was cotton. And I'm sure a lot of us know that, you know, with the invention of the cotton gin, it made slave labor and cotton extremely lucrative. And they had no desire to change. So these plantation owners, they controlled a vast majority of the wealth. This plantation society was distinctly rural. So with agriculture, there's no incentive for urbanization. So one of the main distinctive elements about the antebellum South was that, like, yeah, there were cities. There was Richmond, there was Atlanta, there was Charleston, you know, Birmingham, all these different places. But these cities were nothing compared to New York, compared to Boston, compared to like Cleveland and Cincinnati, like Pittsburgh. There's these major industrial cities in the North were actual urban centers, whereas in the South, like there was not much. And that agricultural economy, like, was distinctly rural. And what you get with a rural culture is you get independence, and you get leave me alone, and you get I'm sufficient, and those kinds of things. Next thing I want to talk about is the honor culture. So I kind of mentioned this with, you know, the ethnic makeup of the white people, like, you know, with your Scottish, your Scots-Irish, and your Irish. Honor culture was huge. Honor was everything. So, and to be 100% honest, I would say that we here in the modern day probably struggle to really understand what an 1850s, 1860s white dude living in the South thought of as honor. While at the same time, like, there's still very much like an understanding of honor, especially in the South today. It's still not quite the same thing. You know, with the internet and globalization, like, it's always kind of shocking to me when I still feel like there are people, I meet people in this world who, like, kind of don't care about honor.
At most, it's kind of devolved into don't make fun of my mama, or, you know, somebody, I don't know. It's almost like a very high school or juvenile level. Like, yes. It's
an immature, like, way of looking at it. Yeah.
It's exactly, that's what I mean. It's not back then you would never see a politician beat another politician now, or somebody who we deem as high status get in a fight with somebody else for insulting them. At most, it is a juvenile reaction, like, don't insult my mama in high school or something like that. Or it breaks out into something like on reality TV where you have people fighting each other over some real or perceived slight. But it's not really condoned. We sort of look at it and mock it now versus looking at it and saying, oh yeah, it makes sense. Like, he insulted his honor. He called him less than.
Yeah.
It makes sense that he goes over there and fights him or canes him or shoots him. Like, you're right. It's completely different now.
It is definitely different, and it's most closely aligned with like this feudal notion of chivalry. It was a very common reference for these plantations owners, like this the nobility in the South, to refer to themselves as knights. That was a very common refrain. You know, this idea that they are part of the knighthood, and that there's this chivalric notion like chivalry and a Southern idea of honor were very similar. Honor, you know, if we were to kind of define it as they thought of it, it included reputation. It included your social status. It included like physical virtue, which to your point, Colin, about like, you know, don't say things about bad about me. Like, okay, that's part of it, but it, we're going beyond that, you know, especially physical virtue and this idea of bravery. You know, again, going back to this knightly notion of like physical prowess in combat is part of this honor notion. And it was like, you know, we would have these plantation owners that would frequently, like, wrestling was a pastime, you know, sports that, you know, had some kind of physicality to it, was important. Sword fighting, was a big deal, you know, either in real life or, you know, fencing as like a sport type deal was a big thing. Honor was such a big deal that if one considered their honor challenged, dueling was still extremely common. And as a matter of fact, dueling was very frequent, even in Washington, D.C., amongst politicians from the South.
Was it Alexander Hamilton and Burr that had a duel?
Yes, they had a duel. That's how Hamilton died. I actually don't recall where Burr was from, but that probably predates like a unique Southern idea. Although, there very much was a ingrained like Southern mentality, even in the Constitution or in the Continental Congress, the Southern states were kind of at odds with the Northern states. It's important to look at slavery in light of this honor culture because when Southerners would hear about abolitionists, which, by the way, you know, we think of abolitionists as just the simple people who were were anti-slavery, and they wanted to end, you know, this terrible institution. And yes, that's true. But from a, you know, if you were to talk about being an abolitionist to a Southern in 1850, they would have thought of an abolitionist as this like wild radical, not a person with common sense that we kind of view it today. They're like, oh, abolitionists, those are crazy people. That's how like ingrained and enmeshed slavery was as an institution in the South. And that when an abolitionist talked about removing slavery, it was considered an affront to honor. You know, it's kind of interesting, and something just came into mind here. Another example of honor that's closely aligned to the Southern notion of honor was actually the Japanese in World War II. There was a Japanese admiral that was quoted as saying, like, we had to go to war because you had offended our honor, speaking to the United States. And it was very much like, you know, we could negotiate until you dishonored us, and then now we will stop at nothing to try to kill you. That was like this relationship between offending honor and violence, not just getting mad, but like physical violence that comes with that to the point of like killing one another. That's what I say. Like, we struggle to understand what honor actually means, because like, it's one thing to get mad. It's another thing to resort to like, I now must kill you because you have offended my honor. Okay. One example, one great example before we move on here, and there's so much to talk about. And that is the caning of Senator Charles Sumner, by South Carolina Senator Preston Brooks. This is an epic story. I'll try to give it briefly. There's a lot of details to talk about here, but, just to give an example of what honor culture was to the South. In 1856, so Bleeding Kansas is in full effect. And I'll talk a little bit more about Bleeding Kansas later. But Bleeding Kansas, you know, pro-slavery and anti-slavery people are killing each other in Kansas. And a Northern senator named Charles Sumner was incensed at what was going on. There were, in fact... you know, pro-slavery Missourians who were causing quite a bit of trouble in Kansas. And he decided to give a 2-day speech. So it was a speech that was planned in to take more than a day. And his title of his speech was called The Crime Against Kansas. And his speech was very passionate, very vociferous. I think that's the right word. Somebody comment if that's not the right use of that word. But it was also highly offensive, even so that at this point in time in 56, there were still Democrats from the North. And a lot of even the Northerners were kind of like, hey, dude, like you kind of went too hard in your speech and distanced themselves from Sumner. Well, a couple days after his speech in the Senate chamber, Preston Brooks from South Carolina walks up to this dude when he's sitting down underneath his desk. When Sumner's sitting underneath his desk, and he walks up to Sumner and he says, "Your speech is libel on South Carolina and my family." So he actually had a relative that Sumner called out in a speech. So he says, "Your speech is libel on South Carolina, my family," and then proceeded to take his gold-headed cane and bludgeon him over the head over 30 times. And the reason why he's able to get away with this is Sumner, who was sitting down, his legs were trapped underneath the desk and he couldn't stand up. So he was like pinned sitting down. This dude whacks him over the head over 30 times. Brooks was not a young man, or sorry, was not an old man, by the way. He was a young, physically healthy guy, beat him over the head over 30 times. Completely debilitated Sumner in a way that he never fully recovered. And there was blood everywhere, and it was a huge ruckus in the Senate chamber. Well, the opposition party voted to try to have a vote to remove him, but because they had a majority vote, but it required a 2-thirds majority. They were not able to get a 2-thirds majority. Well, Brooks decides that he's going to resign anyway. Goes back to South Carolina and decides that his ultimate vindication would be to get reelected, which he does. South Carolina reelects him, sends him back to Washington, D.C. And just like in the most perfect example of what Southern honor culture was, Brooks received canes from all over the South, of which a few of them were engraved with slogans like, "Hit him again." And it was like, it was this view that like, not only did this guy do the wrong thing, he did something honorable and like very much justified because their honor had been offended.
I think it's interesting that he said, "You have offended South Carolina and my family." So they didn't just view dishonor to themselves or just their immediate family, but their entire state. Like everyone on their behalf, he felt anger and he made sure that was the first thing he said. He didn't say my family and my state. He said my state, South Carolina and my family.
Yeah. Yeah. The my family is an indirect quote. He actually, this is maybe a little too much detail, but just for the sake of transparency, he was referring to a cousin of his, and he said his cousin name. I don't have it right in front of me, but this guy, his cousin, I think it was his cousin or some relative, Sumner explicitly called out in his speech. So this guy was like, "You offended South Carolina and, or your speech is libel against South Carolina and, you know, cousin so-and-so." So, it was a family member and, big deal. Also another twist of just, I laugh not because it's okay, but it's just like, again, somewhat sympathetic to the South here. Three different towns renamed themselves Brooksville immediately after this dude, you bludgeoned this guy in the Senate. There was a town in Florida, West Virginia, and Virginia. Oh, which by the way, it's modern day West Virginia. In 1856, there was no West Virginia. It was just Virginia. So modern day West Virginia, then two towns in Virginia, one in Florida. He's from South Carolina. Renamed themselves Brooksville, all in like shows of solidarity Now you can imagine, and it's not really the focus of this episode, but you can imagine the response caused an uproar in the North as well. And they kind of saw, and we'll touch on this towards the end of the episode, but you know, the North saw an aggressive pro-slavery movement, and they saw this guy literally beating a dude, and there were a series of political cartoons talked about, this is the only way the South can argue. They don't have good arguments. They only have sticks. And you can see this kind of leading up to the Civil War here, but just to help us understand the South, that's, you know, dude literally getting to beat within an inch of his life in the Senate chamber is a good example of honor culture. Okay. So I've talked a lot about honor culture. We've talked, and just to kind of briefly touch on what life was like for this landed elite. Actually, in the book that I'm going to recommend at the end of the episode, they talk about how it's a very common refrain from people not in the South to refer to Southerners as like dumb or ignorant. And I have personally in my life been discriminated against. I don't believe I have that thick of an accent. I think my accent is only when I say certain words and I'm not thinking about it. But I have personally been called an idiot for no other reason than my accent. And the person, and I say that because the person literally said, "Your accent makes you sound dumb."
You know, it's funny that you say that. I don't really have a, other than when I say y'all, I don't really have an accent. And so people have not realized I'm from the South. And when I tell them I'm born and raised there, my family's from the South and, you know, the deep South at that. And they turn around, they're like, "Oh, you didn't strike me as a Southerner at all," implying that they thought that you would be an idiot.
Yes.
If you're from the South. So because they didn't know that I was from the South, I didn't have the accent as a giveaway, and I didn't come off as a total idiot. They thought that they didn't think I was a Southerner, and they were shocked when I told them.
Yeah. It's an unfortunate bias and stereotype against Southerners. So, you know, this is the 1800s. Literacy is not 100%. There was no like formal federal state-run educational system in the way that we think of public schools today. And with a predominantly rural culture, you did have a lot of illiteracy and a lot of ignorant people. But at the same time, you know, when you think of urban environments, they have similar, but for different reasons, issues with education. So it was like, but in both the North and the South, there was illiteracy, there was ignorance, for whatever reason. And in the book, again, in the book that I'm going to recommend here at the end of the podcast, the authors make a very good argument talking about how like the South actually had a rich and robust intellectual tradition, that engaged quite a bit with Northern philosophers and authors, with European intellectuals, and there very much was a robust intellectual system that came with the landed aristocracy to defend slavery, to defend agriculture. As a matter of fact, there's a really good quote from Thomas Jefferson. So again, Virginian, lived during the 17, slightly into the 1800s, but, you know, we don't think of Thomas Jefferson as a Southerner per se, but Jefferson is the father of the Democratic Party, and Thomas Jefferson is known as a Renaissance man. Like, the dude was brilliant, and he is like a very good example of, you know, this is a guy who was smarter than the vast majority of us today, was very much a Renaissance man. And yet he owned slaves. He was, you know, part of the landed aristocracy in Virginia. And here's a good quote to them, kind of help understand this how the aristocracy thought. He says, "Those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God, whose breasts he has made his peculiar deposit for substantial and genuine virtue. The proportion of urban workingmen to farmers in any society is the proportion of its unsound to its healthy parts. And then he later goes on to describe, he's like, he says, basically, urban people are as helpful to a government as sores are on a body to its physical health. I.e., like, you know, the only good parts of culture is this landed aristocracy. So it's like, so when we think about the intellectual tradition, when we think about how the South viewed itself, when we think about how the aristocracy, you know, thought of itself, it did have this intellectual tradition, and it very much saw itself as like the pinnacle of civilization. All right. With that, segueing into what some of the political ideas, and a lot of this honestly is going to sound familiar, and this is, it's so fascinating. It's actually going to be my book recommendation for the next episode. So I don't want to say the name of the book because I want y'all to be waiting with bated breath on book recommendations here. But this book talks about the political arguments that a lot of the South was making. And so much of it is, you know, it could have been written yesterday. So in the South, federalism was the primary political view. And when I say federalism, it's actually more helpful to think of it in a more modern sense of federalism, as opposed to the federalist versus anti-federalist argument. And I say more helpful because it's not that it's inaccurate, but so federalism, in the more modern sense of the word, is this idea that there should be a federal government. The federal government should have certain powers. However, the primary body politic of an American's day-to-day life is their local and state governments. The federal government only exists to secure certain rights that have been expressly delegated to it by the Constitution, and any rights not expressly given to it are actually referred to the states. That specific phrase that I just said is actually considered an anti-federalist state or statement at the time, like, you know, that the Bill of Rights was written. But in terms of what we think of as modern federalism, it really incorporates a lot of the arguments that the anti-federalists were making. And as opposed to today, you know, especially after the 1960s and really in the 1930s with FDR into the 1960s and like LBJ's Great Society, like we see the federal government becoming a much more dominant and primary body politic for everyday Americans. And that's not consistent with the Federalist view. So when we think about Southerners being primarily Federalist, it was states' rights and leave me alone. Like, hey, what you want to go do in New York and what you want to go do in Pennsylvania and Ohio, go knock yourselves out. I'm gonna do what I want to do, and the federal government doesn't exist to enforce your northern way of life on me. That's how the federalist argument kind of plays in there. Colin, you look like you're deep in thought.
To be honest, I'm learning a lot.
Okay.
I mean,
good.
Like, this is kind of one of those topics where it's like, even growing up in the South, and considering myself a history aficionado, mm-hmm. you don't really talk enough about the honor aspect of it, the political leanings of most of the people and kind of what their thought process was. Like most people now, it's such a black and white, why did the Civil War start? And they just go slavery. And you're like, yes, mm-hmm. but it's kind of like if you were to visualize it, or this is the way I thought of it, it's like a hub and spoke. Like in the hub was slavery. Like, yes, that was the core issue. There's all these other spokes coming out of it, like honor culture, federalism, and political disagreements, the economics of it. You know, all of these different other things kind of stream out of it. And so it's really not as cut and dry as most people think it is. And then, you know, you never talk about honor. I'm going back and just rethinking about the honor culture aspect of it. Yeah. And it's very interesting just thinking about it because it's so foreign to people now. Like we can't even conceptualize it now.
Right. Yeah, it's, you mentioned something there that I wanted to touch on, and that is, you know, growing up, I heard the phrase, the Civil War was not about slavery. It was about states' rights. And honestly, this, on the statement, was this, or on the question, was the Civil War about states' rights? Yes, it absolutely was about states' rights. On the question, was the Civil War about slavery? The answer to that question is yes, the Civil War was absolutely about slavery. Because the primary right that Southerners believed was a state's right that they wanted to defend was the right to slavery. So it was,
it's
like,
always,
yes,
that follow-up question, the right to do what?
The right to do what? The right to have slaves. And I'm not going to read it here, but if, you know, for those of y'all that just love further reading, I highly recommend Google the South Carolina, I feel terrible because I don't recall the exact title of the document, but the South Carolina Statement of Secession, like the Declaration of Secession. It was the document that South Carolina, you know, ratified, saying that we secede from the Union. That document is basically exclusively about slavery. And to me, that was actually personally in my mind, as I remember being a teenager and having really good history teachers in high school and in college, help me walk through this, like, no, the civil, like, slavery was the central issue. And it, like, at, and it's not inaccurate to think of it as a state's right. Like, yes, from the Southern perspective, it was state's rights, but also, like, the right was slavery. And in this document for the South Carolina Articles of Secession, they, like, vehemently defend the institution of slavery. So, you know, if you read, and it, we keep referring back to South Carolina because, you know, honestly, my humble opinion, the most, like, outspoken and most vehement state in the South, like the most wily state, has always been South Carolina. They fired the first shots of the Civil War, you know, the firing on the Citadel on the Fort Sumter, like they started the Civil War.
There's actually a ship going out to Fort Sumter called the Star of the West. Little known fact. Right.
An unarmed Union supply steamer.
It was not directly on Fort Sumter. From Sumter. Sumter. It was Sumter. The Star of the West.
Yeah. So if you're going to look at, like, what is the sine qua non of secession articles, it is South Carolina. And it's all about slavery. So, but that view of slavery was like, it's my right and I have the right, and stop trying to take my rights. And you don't have the legal nor the moral justification to take this right from me. Just for the sake of time, moving on to the religious worldview, the vast majority of people to the South held on to a particular view of Protestantism. Yes, there were Catholics in the South, you know, notably in Louisiana and Georgia, but the overwhelming majority were, you know, Protestants from the British Isles. So there were two things. Honestly, I wish we had more time to go over the nuances of this argument, but I'm going to cover them quicker than I probably want to. And that is, in this view of Protestantism, Southerners saw slavery as not being explicitly condemned in the Bible. It was a religious argument, a theological argument, where that interpretation of the Bible sees a lack of a condemnation of slavery as, well, God didn't say we can't have slaves, so I can have slaves. The second thing, you know, again, this is religious beliefs here, was they saw slavery as a positive good, i.e., you know, the concept of common good is a common theological system belief, you know, for the common good type deal. They believe slavery was actually a good thing. And, you know, kind of thinking back to this, you know, White Man's Burden, which is actually a British poem by a British guy. But this idea that it's like, we are helping Black people improve their quality of life. Like, we're giving them a job, we're giving them food, we're giving them shelter, we're actually improving their lot in life, as opposed to if slavery didn't exist as an institution, their lot in life would be worse. And that was the religious positive articulation of why slavery needed to exist as an institution. Colin, you look like you're about to say something.
What's it called? It's like allowed. It's kind of like, well, if you agree with this, don't say anything. Kind of like the omission. There's a legal term, I'm sure, where it's like, well, it doesn't say it's wrong, but it,
yeah.
But yeah, I think that's an interesting conceptually argument. It's like,
yeah, conceptually, I get what you're saying. I don't know the,
like,
term.
Well, the Bible doesn't explicitly say it's wrong, so I can do it. Like, well, it's not really keeping in the spirit of what is actually being said.
Yeah. And so, okay.
I mean, technically, it kind of does actually also say that. It's like, you know, if you were to break down, like, neither a lender nor a debtor be, you know, go into those verses, it's kind of like, well, like, don't have slaves.
Yeah. So I can't help myself. I will somewhat go into the theological trenches here. Because I think it is helpful to kind of understand, like, you know, it seems pretty uncontroversial within Protestantism and Catholicism, but Christianity in general, that polygamy is not okay, right? That it is immoral and not allowed to have multiple wives. However, there are multiple instances where, you know, righteous, quote unquote, righteous people especially in the Old Testament had multiple wives, and there is absent any kind of specific condemnation, against those, you know, having multiple wives. I think of slavery in the Bible, I tend to think of it in the same category as, like, there were realities that God allowed for a season, not saying that they were good, but rather he just allowed people to walk in the times of their former ignorance, for a reason, but that doesn't make it okay in today, right? And in the same way that we would say that marriage is between one man and one woman, even though that phrase, in the way that it's one man and one woman, is not in the Bible. It says between a man and a woman, of which it doesn't say one. We add in the number one there, by the way. But we still say that polygamy is wrong. In the same way, I think we're theologically still safe to say that slavery is wrong from a religious and theological perspective, even though the Bible doesn't explicitly say the words, slavery is sin. You know what I mean? I can't help myself. That was a theological argument.
It's good. No, good stuff.
Okay, so that was the religious worldview. It's super fast on that kind of thing. Okay, in the time that we have remaining, just going to quickly go over, like, I want to lead us into our next episode on what were the aspects of this culture that led it into the Civil War. Kind of rapid fire here. There was a growing belief and a growing recognition that two distinct civilizations have actually emerged. Don't know, you know, the seeds were kind of always there, even in colonial times. But come 1860, Southerners did not view themselves as having a shared identity with the North. And as a matter of fact, the Southerners had been threatening secession for decades. Unlike in the American Revolution, where I think the first time, and this is a total rough guess here, but I think the first time literally anybody in the colonies talked about seceding and declaring independence from Great Britain was like 1771 or two, maybe. Like, it was less than 10 years prior to the American Revolution. This is different from the Civil War, where it was like literally 20 plus years that Southerners had been threatening secession for a long time. Like, this had been talked about for a while. So there was this growing belief that was really solidified itself that the South was a distinct culture and a distinct society that no longer had its interest being represented in Washington, D.C., and it needed to form a separate government. Two, and kind of going back to the key takeaway on Pride here, there was a Southern belief that they could actually defeat the North militarily. The movie, and I think I started to go on this point and then got distracted earlier in the episode, but the movie Gone with the Wind has this really great scene with, you know, they're having this, you know, aristocratic ball at one of the plantations, and they get this news that there's going to be a war, and they talk about like how they're going to whip the North, and it's like, we'll send those Yankees running back up to where they came from type deal. I think it was at the news that Lincoln had called up 70,000 soldiers, which in large part, you know, that from the Southern perspective, the election of Abraham Lincoln caused secession, but that didn't cause a war. It's not like the South attacked the North because Lincoln got elected. They just seceded and wanted to be left alone. But Lincoln, in response to the secession, called up 70,000 reserves and mobilized an army to invade the South. And the South, that's what like was the was one of the causes of the Civil War. Lincoln didn't have to do that, but he wanted to preserve the Union. Okay. So there was a Southern belief that they could actually defeat the North. There was a view that abolitionism was a radical ideology. The South viewed its culture as being under attack. And that's why they felt like they needed to secede. And then one last point kind of from the Northern perspective is in the same way that the South viewed abolition as a radical ideology, the North saw what was called the slave power movement as a radical and hostile ideology as well. Just kind of anecdotally, in the decades leading up to the Civil War, there were actually multiple Southern attempts to start wars in the Caribbean and Central America to try to like conquer and annex. Most explicitly, there were several attempts to conquer Cuba, and presidential, you know, pro-Southern presidential administrations made several offers to try to buy Cuba from the Spanish. But there were also like a bunch of rogue invasion attempts by Southern buccaneers to try to conquer Cuba. And there was several attempts to try to conquer Nicaragua of all places. And I believe the Nicaraguans have actually, that's one reason why the Nicaraguans have always been historically hostile to the United States. They're like the one country in Central America that has never gotten along with us. And in the fast forward to the Cold War, Nicaragua has actually been very pro-Russia. And part of the reason is that Southerners during the 1800s tried to invade their country multiple times to take over.
For Cuba, they should have just waited till the papers got a little bit bigger. And I'll start a war right away.
The papers get a little bit bigger?
Yeah, remember it was called yellow journalism?
Oh, newspapers. Newspapers, yeah.
They should have just waited, you know, 30 more years.
That's right. Yeah, they were almost there. Teddy Roosevelt. So in the explicit reason why they wanted to conquer these territories was just so that they could expand the institution of slavery and that they could get, you know, two more senators and a congressman into Congress so that it would be like pro-Southern. But probably one of the number one things, and the author in next week's book recommendation says this, the single biggest event that occurred that pushed the nation to civil war was the Kansas and Nebraska Act. The key things about this act was it repealed the Missouri Compromise. So the Missouri Compromise was a compromise that in the Louisiana Purchase, territories north of the 3630 parallel would be free states, and the states that organized below that parallel would be slave states. The Kansas and Nebraska Act repealed that because it said that the settlers, when they organize and form a state constitution and appeal to the Congress in D.C. for statehood, that they will have a vote on whether or not they will be slave or free states. And it won't be arbitrary based on if they're north or south of a parallel. what this did was this laid the foundation for Bleeding Kansas, which created a lot of angst across the country, because what happened was people from Missouri, who are north, Missouri is north of the 3630 parallel, and they were exempted from the Missouri Compromise, i.e. like all of the other states north of that parallel except Missouri would be free states. Well, Missouri and Kansas are right next to each other. When it was decided via the Kansas and Nebraska Act that the settlers would choose for themselves whether or not they'd be slave or free, Missourians started crossing the border and voting in Kansas elections. So election racketeering and interference has been a longstanding American tradition. In pro-slavery Missourians in the thousands would go vote in Kansas elections. And it was so bad that a local Kansas the first legislature that was elected in Kansas was in Lecompte. I'm not sure if I'm saying that name, but in Lecompte, Kansas. Or Lecompte, I don't know. Kansas. And they elected by Missourian racketeering, a pro-slavery legislature. And it was so bad that the Free Soilers formed a different state Congress in Topeka. And you had two competing alternative state legislatures, one in Lecompte, one in Topeka. And that's where you get the Jayhawks phrase. You know, everybody knows about Kansas Jayhawks. The Jayhawks were the pro Free Soilers, the anti-slavery party that was kind of defending and, you know, blah, 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 in Kansas. John Brown, the guy who's he was a anti-slavery radical that murdered a lot of pro-slavery people, him and his 20 children, he had 20 kids. So him and his boys were part of a gang that, straight up murdered people, murdered slaveholders, etc. It was just a really bad situation. Not a great episode in our nation's history. And that was one of the bigger things that moved our country to the state of war. That kind of closes us out. That brings us, you know, our next episode, we'll talk about the Civil War and Sherman's March to the Sea and what happened there. If you've been listening, if you stayed with us to the end, thank you so much. The book recommendation that I want to give is called The Mind of the Masterclass by Fox Genovese and her husband, another guy named Genovese. It is not a very well-known book, like in terms of pop culture, but it is absolutely fantastic in helping explain what, you know, the intellectual, moral, and religious underpinnings of the aristocracy, moral and religious justifications from slavery, economic perspectives, political perspectives. And they give it, there's a really good section on comparing it with Northern society and how those two things were different. So The Mind of the Masterclass by the Genovese, fantastic, highly recommended book that, you know, obviously served as the basis for a lot of the thoughts in this podcast. So with that, Colin, I'll turn it over to you.
Jay, great episode. I think you really did a good job of summarizing what antebellum South looked like. Race relations, honor, culture, politics, the economics of it, and kind of what gave the lead up to the Civil War. So very fascinating. I know I learned a lot just listening and kind of going over your notes for this. It's very, very informative. So I hope you learned something, and you stay tuned for next week's episode on Sherman's March to the Sea. If you like what we're doing here, you heard us at the beginning, give shout outs, give a comment, give a rating. That way we can give you a shout out. Jay and I are on social media, on Instagram, Facebook, X, even a few others. So on some sort of iteration of Loins of History, feel free to reach out to us. We've had some fans reach out via Gmail as well. So message us, let us know some recommendations, some feedback that you have. We do appreciate it. Love to get your thoughts, and thanks for listening to the Loins of History, and we'll see you next week.